Invite you to open your Bibles this morning to Daniel chapter 2. We continue in our series, Daniel, the Rule of God. There are some things we do not know, some things that are hard to know, and some things that are impossible to know. God is the one who knows and reveals truth. Now, we'll be looking at the first 30 verses of this chapter, and what we'll do is we'll stand and read the first 9 verses when I give you the cue. And then, as we go through the sermon, I will be reading the rest of the portion that we're looking at today. As we do that, as we read at different places all through the message, what I'd like you to note is how many times it says know or make known. Those of you that are OCD may want to count. There are 18 of them. And how many times it says God revealed things? There's 5 of those. So be looking for those as we make our way through the passage. Just the point of this text is God is the one who knows and reveals truth. Let's stand for the reading of the scriptures. Daniel chapter 2, verses 1 through 9. In the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His spirit was troubled and his sleep left him. Then the king commanded that the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans be summoned to tell the king his dreams. So they came in and stood before the king. And the king said to them, I had a dream, and my spirit is troubled to know the dream. Then the Chaldeans said to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever, tell your servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, The word from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you shall be torn limb from limb, and your houses shall be laid in ruins. But if you show the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, show me the dream and its interpretation. They answered a second time and said, Let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation. The king answered and said, I know with certainty that you are trying to gain time because you see that the word from me is firm. If you do not make the dream known to me, there is but one sentence for you. You have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the times change. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can show me its interpretation. The Chaldeans answered the king and said, There is not a man on earth who can meet the king's demand, for no great and powerful king has asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean. The thing that the king asks is difficult, and no one can show it to the king except the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh. Please be seated. Got a little excited there and read 2 more verses, but that's okay, right? You'll allow me that mistake. Who has the authority to know and reveal truth? The king has a dream, and he's troubled by it. And and this is just true generally, those in authority and responsibility often are fitful in their sleep and are troubled. It just goes with the territory of being a person having authority. The king is thinking, as we'll find out next week, he's thinking about his legacy as he goes to bed. And as a result, has this dream. We'll talk more about that next week. But the king is a doubting leader. Here's what he doubts. Do those who advise me, do they really know their stuff? Do they really know what they say they know? And can I trust them? And are they for me? This is a big challenge. And by the way, just so you know, get it out of the way before we get too far, in chapter 2, verse 4, where it says that these wise men, Chaldeans, said to the king in Aramaic, from chapter 2, verse 4, all the way through to the end of chapter 7, the language of Daniel changes. The Old Testament is written mostly in Hebrew. I mean, 99.some percent. The biggest section that's not in Hebrew is Daniel 2 through 7. It's not explained in the text why, although Aramaic was the common trade language of the Middle East at this time. So maybe it's to show that God's rule and his kingdom extends worldwide, and that the shift back to Hebrew in chapter 8 might be because God also has a specific heart for his people Israel, a compassion that will last for all eternity. But we'll talk more about that when we get to the end of chapter 7. At any rate, note that the language actually changes for these chapters from 2 through 7. We have these guys that are called in verse 2, magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, Chaldeans. There's actually six different titles given to these people in Daniel chapter 2. Is it right to call these guys scientists? Is this the technology, the highest form of the science of the day? Well, no and yes. Not in the sense of Western science. Western science came directly from Christianity. It's interesting, by the way, the reasons why. Christianity said, for example, that the physical universe is real, not imaginary, and that what happens in the physical world matters as opposed to just finding some bliss within. So a lot of the Eastern religions, even though there were people that were very smart in the East, because of the worldview that said that the physical universe wasn't real, or that what really mattered was finding a bliss within rather than understanding the world outside you, they just didn't find that it was all that important to study it. Christianity asserted that there is one intelligent, personal, and rational God who has made all that exists, and therefore what exists can be understood. This is why the Christian West developed science and the East did not. It was not that the East was less smart. It was that the East was operating on faulty ideas. So, not in the sense of Western science can we call these guys scientists. But were they scientists in the sense of trying to make sense of their world and explain its phenomena? Yes, indeed, they were. These were the highest of the smart guys of the kingdom. By the way, they loved base 60 mathematics. The reason why you have 60 seconds in your minute and 60 minutes in your hour is because of Babylonian science. The reason you have 360 degrees to your compass is because of Babylonian science. Philip Ball wrote an interesting article in The Atlantic where he says, the Babylonian astronomers surveyed the skies carefully, keeping detailed records of the movements of the stars and planets. They recognized five planets, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, along with the sun and moon, and called them wild sheep because of their wandering paths over the fixed backdrop of the stars. What he's talking about is what is commonly called retrograde motion, where it appears that the planets are moving backwards because we live in a heliocentric solar system and not in a geocentric one, and some of you are falling asleep and others of you are leaning in, right? The fact is, the Babylonians knew this stuff. They knew that there was a cycle of 223 months in the pattern of eclipses. They knew that Saturn rises in the same place in the sky after every 59 years, which took more than one 59-year cycle to figure out. But they were operating out of a worldview where the world was not supposed to make sense, that there were multiple gods who competed with one another, after all. Ball says, the Babylonians believed their gods transmitted messages about the future through the appearance of the celestial bodies. When planets rose, what color they were, where they stood in certain arrangements, when eclipses happened, it was the task of scholarly diviners to interpret these messages so that they could deliver, listen, sound advice to the king. So these men were called upon to make sense of their world. And one particular phenomenon, which even in today's Middle East carries tons of meaning, is the world of our dreams. And so the Babylonians actually had, and we have discovered, archaeologists have discovered, volumes of books of dream interpretation from the Babylonian Empire. What these guys were saying is, tell us the dream, king. We will consult our volumes, our collective wisdom, and we will tell you the interpretation of the dream. The king, however, is uncertain. He's uncertain if he can trust his advisors, his scientists, his guys, and with good reason. Babylonian kings often were assassinated. Two kings before Nebuchadnezzar in the previous 100 years had been assassinated. Two of them in the 22 years after he reigned were assassinated. One of them was his own son. Now, this phrase that's found here where it says that the thing is firm, right? He's had a dream. He wants to know the dream. Verse 5, the king answered, said to the Chaldeans, "The word from me is firm." Some translations say it's gone from me. That is not correct. It's not that the king forgot the dream. He knows the dream. He just wants to find out whether these guys really are sharp or whether they're just blowing smoke. Or worse, they're deceiving him. He doesn't know the truth. Who has the authority to know and reveal truth? Nebuchadnezzar is troubled by that. And so he's purposely keeping this information from his brain trust in order to find out how good they are. And this verse 5, torn limb from limb. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you shall be torn limb from limb. That is not poetic imagery here. That is literal. The Aramaic says, "You will be body parts." That's kind of an interesting phrase, huh? Don't tell me the dream and interpretation. You'll be body parts. That's what you'll be. So two times here, the advisors say, verse 4 and verse 7, tell us the dream. Nebuchadnezzar thinks they're stalling. In fact, he thinks they're more than stalling. Now his mind has gone to conspiracy. Look at verse 9. If you do not make known the dream, there's one sentence for you. You have agreed, that's a conspiracy, to speak lying and corrupt words before me. He thinks they're stalling, and they're more than stalling, that they are conspiring to agree to speak lies and corrupt words to him. He's got his doubts about these guys, and now that they're fudging on getting him the answer right now, he's saying, now I know it. He doesn't know who has the authority to know and reveal truth. Now, we have the same problem today, more so than at any time that I've ever lived, the problem of knowing who is the authority on truth. Let me share with you a couple of reasons why. We've got fake news, which is the deliberate advancing of misinformation for some evil purpose, usually getting money or power from the unsuspecting. Then there's poor journalism. The result of postmodernism, I won't go long into that, but journalists did such a poor job of reporting that now telling bad reporters from good ones is nearly impossible. What happens is that we all end up tending to believe reporters that we agree with and dismiss reporting that we don't agree with. Well, that's not really the basis on which we find out truth, is it? We agree with you, therefore you're right? No, that's silly, but that's what we're doing. This is particularly problematic in how the press handles most science stories. Journalism does not understand the science in many cases. How could they, after all? They're not scientists. Journalism goes for the sensational headlines when the researchers are always way more muted. You know, butter will kill you, margarine will kill you. The scientists never said that. The journalists reporting about the science said that, right? Journalism does not understand the scientific method of publishing a study, which will be studied by others and refined. And then, not only is there fake news and poor journalism, there's conspiracy. Just as in Nebuchadnezzar's day, there are conspiracies. The effects of the fall are upon us all. I'll just mention two in the scientific world. In 1998, Andrew Wakefield published a study which suggested that the MMR vaccine may predispose children to behavioral regression and pervasive development disorder. Since that, and his study has been repudiated and found out to be a total fraud, and they've falsified facts, and he did it in order to gain financially. And yet today, an entire generation of people, unlike before that study, now wonder, what do I do about vaccinating my children? In 2004 and 5, there was a South Korean by the name of Wong Woo-suk who published these articles in the journal Science, a very prestigious magazine, reporting that he had succeeded in creating human embryonic stem cells by cloning. It was a complete fabrication. He made it up. This all leads to the thoughts that there's conspiracy everywhere. That's not true, but the question, who and what can you trust is certainly there. The net effect of all of this is that for this foreseeable future, for the rest of your lives, there will be real problems in trying to figure out what is true and what is not. We, my friends, live in Nebuchadnezzar's palace. Let's look now at verses 10 through 16. I read them before, but they're so good, we'll read them again. Verse 10, the Chaldeans answered the king and said, "There's not a man on earth who can meet the king's demand, for no great and powerful king has asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean. The thing that the king asks is difficult, and no one can show it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh." Because of this, the king was angry and very furious and commanded that all the wise men of Babylon be destroyed. So the decree went out, and the wise men were about to be killed, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. Then Daniel replied with prudence and discretion to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. He declared to Arioch, the king's captain, "Why is the decree of the king so urgent?" Then Arioch made the matter known to Daniel, and Daniel went in and requested the king to appoint him a time that he might show the interpretation to the king. There is a problem of science in knowing and revealing truth. Some people want to think that the way out from the difficulty of knowing is by an appeal to science and technology. But there are some questions that should not be asked to science and technology. Notice how these guys answer. "There's not a man on earth who can meet the king's demand of telling another person's hidden thoughts. Science and technology can't read minds." And notice how they give a gentle put down of Nebuchadnezzar here. Do you see it in verse 10? Where they say, "No great and powerful king has asked such a thing of any magician or conjurer." What are they implying there? If you were really a great and powerful king, this is not a question you would be asking us smart people, right? A little put down. If he really were a great and powerful king, he wouldn't be asking such a question. Now notice what they say in response, in also saying that science has problems in knowing and revealing truth. Verse 11, "The thing that the king asks is difficult. There are indeed some questions that are very, very difficult. It takes years of building up the combined efforts of many, many people from many fields all over the world to come up with the answers. The solving of Ebola, AIDS, cancer, renewable energy do not just happen overnight because some really smart people study them. They are difficult questions." They go on to say, though, the thing that the king asks is difficult, and no one can show it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh. There are some questions that science and technology cannot answer. Only God can answer them. They're known only by God's direct revelation to us. The wise men of Babylon assert some questions are not known and indeed are not knowable by science and technology. Questions like, "Who am I? Why am I here? How's it all going to end?" Those are questions science and technology cannot answer for us. The king, of course, being a politician, has an exaggerated sense of what he can order to happen. Like we can just order something. So he thinks if he simply adjusts the amount of pressure on his brain trust, they will be motivated to answer. Look at verse 12. "Because of this, the king was angry and very furious." You'll see all through the language of Daniel these repeated phrases, like "the king answered and said." Like, why do they say "and said" if they already answered? And why not just "said"? Why does it "answered and said"? "The king was angry and very furious." Why is this kind of repeated phrasing happening here? Well, it's a very Middle Eastern way to tell stories. It heightens tension and reality. The same happens with repetition of the stories, as we will see in chapters 3 and 4. Note that Daniel, in verse 14, is the picture of composure when everyone else is literally losing their heads. Daniel replied with prudence and discretion to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill the wise men. He asks a good question. Verse 15, "Why is this so urgent? Why is the king so harsh? When we see people behaving unreasonably, and there are reasons for it, it's prudent to try to figure it out, and that's what Daniel's going to do. In verse 16, just like he did in chapter 1, he asks for time. Time's going to give opportunity for something that we'll see in the next section, verses 17 through 24. God is the one who knows and reveals all truth. Look with me at verse 17. Then Daniel went to his house, made the matter known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, and told them to seek mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his companions might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision of the night. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise. For you have given me wisdom and might and have now made known to me what we asked of you. For you have made known to us the king's matter." Therefore Daniel went into Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went in and said thus to him, "Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Bring me in before the king, and I will show the king the interpretation." When we do not know, when it is hard to know, when in fact it is impossible for us to know, we must band together and pray to the one who knows and reveals all truth. Notice the banding together there in verse 17. Daniel went to his house, and he makes the matter known to his small group. He's got a small group of three guys, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, and the four of them meet together at Daniel's house. You guys might think that small groups are an invention of the 20th century or something and has never happened ever before in the history of mankind, when in fact there is value to a small group of banding together when you are at a spot where it is impossible. You don't know what you're going to do. You band together. His companions and friends banded together. Note their small group met at the house, right? Daniel's house. And what did they do? He told them to seek mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery. They prayed. They sought mercy from the God of heaven. This description of God is important, the God of heaven. It means that he is above the fray of ignorance. He's above it. He knows everything, and he's above it. So we seek the mercy of the God of heaven. He's in his heaven, completely knowledgeable of all things. And one thing that's kind of interesting about that verse, seek mercy from the God of heaven, it's literally from before the God of heaven. And that word before is important because all through this chapter, they're going before the king in real intimidating places. Chapter 2, verse 2, the wise men go before the king, and it's supposed to be a pretty intimidating place. And in verses 24, 25, 27, Daniel's talking about going before the king. But before they go, Daniel, before he goes before the earthly king, he goes before the God of heaven. That's a beautiful thing, isn't it? And by the way, verse 18, it looks like the killing of the wise men had already begun. You see, he told them to seek told these guys, he says, "Let's seek mercy from the God of heaven so that Daniel and his companions might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon." But maybe it's already happening. God reveals, verse 19, the mystery to Daniel in a vision of the night. The mystery's known in the same way that it began. And in verses 20 through 23, we have this beautiful picture of praise that says God is the one who knows and reveals all truth. Let's break it down. Verse 20, "There is a forever God who deserves our praise. Blessed be the name of God forever and ever. To him belong wisdom and might." He possesses wisdom and might. I want you to notice verse 23 then and see. God's the one in heaven above the fray of ignorance. He knows everything. Wisdom and might belong to him. And notice the same phrase, wisdom and might, is found in verse 23. "To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for you have given me wisdom and might." That amazing? That the God of heaven, we call on him in our small group. And the things that are unknowable to us, we cannot know them. No one knows except the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh, is what the Babylonian scientist said. And God has made it known. He possesses wisdom and might. He's given me wisdom and might. Verse 21, he possesses wisdom and might over natural phenomenon. He's in charge of times and seasons. He's in charge of politics. Who's king? Who gets put down as the king? He's in charge of all of that. Verse 21, he's the one who dispenses wisdom and knowledge to human beings. Most of the time, that's via natural processes, but sometimes via supernatural ones. He's the one who dispenses it as he wills. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. Verse 22, he possesses wisdom and might over supernatural phenomena. That is deep and hidden things. Not only is in charge of times and seasons and kings and stuff, that's natural stuff. He's in charge of supernatural things, deep and hidden things. He knows what's in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. Things that are not known or hard to know or impossible to know, our God knows them all. This idea of God knowing the darkness and light dwelling with him is picked up in the New Testament in the Gospel of John. John chapter 1, it says, in him, in Jesus, was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness. The darkness has not overcome it. Verse 9 of John 1, the true light which gives light to everyone was coming into the world. John 8:12, Jesus himself says, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. John 12:46, Jesus says, I have come into the world as light, so that whoever believes in me may not remain in darkness. So here's this God of Daniel who knows what's in the darkness. Light dwells with him. And in the New Testament, what we have is God has sent his Son into this world to be the light of the world. 1 John 1:5, this is the message we've heard from him and proclaimed to you, that God is light, and in him there's no darkness at all. And so he says, bring me before the king in verse 24. Here's some applications for this section. In a world where we do not know, it's hard to know, it's impossible to know. If you're a believer in Jesus, you've got to be in a small group. If you live in Nebuchadnezzar's palace, you have to be in a small group where you can pray with your brothers and sisters for help in the midst of circumstances where you don't know. Pray for mercy from the God of heaven, because God is the one who knows and reveals truth. So now let's look at the last section. Then Arioch brought in Daniel before the king in haste and said thus to him, I've found among the exiles from Judah a man who will make known to me, to the king, the interpretation. The king declared to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, are you able to make known to me the dream that I have seen and its interpretation? Daniel answered the king, said, no wise man, enchanters, magicians, or astrologers can show the king the mystery that the king has asked, but there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. And he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions of your head as you lay in bed are these. To you, O king, as you lay in bed came thoughts of what would be after this. And he who reveals mysteries made known to you what it is to be. But as for me, this mystery has been revealed to me, not because of any wisdom that I have more than all the living, but in order that the interpretation may be known to the king and that you may know the thoughts of your mind. We must testify to God's rule in knowing and revealing the truth. There's a little humor here. Arioch hurries into the king. He doesn't want to be killing people after all. And further, what he says is, I have found among the exiles one who will make known the interpretation. Only by stretching the definition of found beyond the breaking point could we say that Arioch found Daniel. Little humor there. Nebuchadnezzar in verse 26 wants to know, can you make known the dream and the interpretation? Daniel says, he affirms what the scientists say, no one can make it known except one. There is a God in heaven who reveals and makes known. Do you see it there? There is a God in heaven above the fray of ignorance. And then he says, this is not about me. It's to you, King. God has let you know what would be after this. He's made known to you what is to be. As for me, this mystery hasn't been revealed to me because any wisdom that I have, I don't have it any more than any other living being. But in order that the interpretation may be known to the king and that you might know the thoughts of your mind, God has done this because he wants to make something known to you, Nebuchadnezzar, even down to telling you the thoughts of your own mind. Here's some ways to think about this. As I've mentioned several times now, there are some things we don't know. There are things that are hard to know. There are things that are impossible for us to know. God is the one who knows and reveals. 18 times in this chapter, know or make known is found. 5 times it says God reveals. It seems to me that all of us ought to get to know this God better, call on him more, gather together and draw near to him. The God of heaven wants to be the God of our fathers. Daniel, in his praise there in verse 23, doesn't call God the God of heaven. He calls him the God of his fathers. It's a language of intimacy. That infinite God that knows everything, he wants to be a personal God too. The second thing, communion, which we're about to enter into, is a physical way to draw near to the God who knows and reveals truth. We are saying as we take the bread, we don't know how to be right. We don't know how to be right with you, God. We can't by our own efforts do it. It is the body of your Son who is the light of the world that has come into the world, a world of darkness. It is the body of your Son that is broken for us that makes us right. We are saying as we drink the cup, we do not know what to do about our sin. We could never pay for it. Your blood, symbolized by this cup, Jesus, brings us forgiveness. You have made known to us what is impossible for us to know. How could we possibly be right with a holy God? You've made it known to us by revealing yourself to us in the person of your Son, our Savior, Jesus. Heavenly Father, as we take up this bread and cup, we'd ask that you would remind us that you are the one who knows, you are the one who reveals the truth. In Jesus' name, amen.